Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm Bert Johnson, and I'll be filling in for Lucia Starbuck today. The show's name refers to the fact that this state isn't red or blue, it's both. Nevada's primary election is less than 2 months away now on June 9th, so we're looking into some of the top issues in this year's race. Last month, we heard from the two Democrats running to be Nevada Attorney General. We invited their Republican opponents for today's show, but both declined. So instead, we spoke to Jeremy Gelman. He's an associate professor of political science at UNR. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's begin with Congressional District 2 here in Northern Nevada. In February, Congressman Mark Amadei announced that instead of running for re-election, he would retire at the end of his current term. The announcement came as a surprise, and it left the district wide open for the first time in more than a decade. 27 candidates filed for the race. Some have since dropped out, but KUNR was able to interview most of them. Who do you think the top contenders are for the June 9th primary?
Yeah, so on the Republican side, James Settlemyer and David Filippo. You see the endorsements on that side sort of splitting, but all of them are sort of going to those two candidates, right? You have Amadei and Joe Lombardo, the governor, endorsing Settlemyer. You have Turning Point Action, the Washoe GOP party, endorsing Filippo. And so you have this very interesting dynamic that I think we'll get into in a second on that side. On the Democratic side, probably Teresa Benitez Thompson, who obviously has a lot of experience in state government. And then Greg Kidd, who self-funding ran last time, maybe has some name recognition from that. But, you know, from what he said and the amount of money he's willing to spend on his campaign, will probably have more money than really any other Democrat and maybe even any other Republican in this election. So there's a lot of other people, maybe the first time running, folks who are trying to get their name out there. You never know if someone's going to emerge from that group, but those four, I think, are the ones to mainly watch.
Democrats, speaking of them, are hoping to flip the district for the first time. Do you think rising costs and President Donald Trump's low approval ratings nationally will be enough to help them get across the finish line?
It's going to be a really tough lift. So what's likely to happen in a midterm election where the president's a Republican is Democrats are going to do well. That's sort of historically what happens. However, this is a really red district. And drawn that way intentionally. It's an intentional gerrymander by the Democrats in the state legislature to give them three really good shots in Clark County and essentially one Republican seat up here. That said, it's a red district, but not so red that we couldn't be surprised if it's a really big Democratic wave in November. There will be some seats that are similar to the partisan lean probably that flip to Democratic from Republican. Which seats they are, though, is pretty difficult to predict. So could it happen in Northern Nevada? It's possible. Is it likely? Probably not.
On the Republican side, we've got James Settlemyer, who you mentioned, former state senator and rancher. He's running with Amadei's endorsement. And then you also mentioned David Filippo. He originally filed to run in Southern Nevada. But when Amadei retired, he changed his mind and threw his hat in the ring for CD2 up here. And as you mentioned, he's got the backing of some of these national MAGA groups like CPAC and Turning Point Action. What do you make of the dynamics in that primary specifically? What's going on there?
It's incredibly interesting, and it's something that's happened across the country in Republican districts for a decade now, even maybe going back to the Tea Party days, 20 years now, I guess, at this point. But it's this fascinating dynamic where you have what you might consider a more establishment candidate, someone with political experience, deep ties to the area, support of incumbent politicians running against someone who is an outsider. You know, Filippo ran previously in Clark County. He's coming up here to run for the first time, and he's really running maybe as an ideologue or someone with the MAGA-style brand. Oftentimes, we're seeing across the country is that Republican primary voters prefer the outsider candidate. They're voting for these amateur candidates more often than they're voting for these more established politicians. Will that happen here? We'll see. But it's this really interesting distillation of Republican primary politics that, you know, we've seen it in Georgia and Colorado and California and lots of other places. And because Amadei and Heller held this seat for so long, it never really happened up here. So how that dynamic's going to play out here, which has played across the country over the past few decades elsewhere, is going to be really, really interesting.
In Northern Nevada specifically, though, there is a culture of, shall we say, not necessarily trusting people from Southern Nevada, if I can be diplomatic about it, right? And so David Filippo, I've already heard people in local Republican politics using the word carpetbagger to describe this guy. Do you think it's going to hurt his chances?
It's certainly something that Settlemyer is going to emphasize. We'll see, though, right? Because it's this dynamic of the things we think tend to matter in politics a lot. Experience, deep ties to the area, things like that, you know, endorsements from the politicians that people have taken their cues from in the past, compared to someone who's essentially running a nationalized campaign on what is Donald Trump's platform. Obviously, if the president gets involved, that's probably going to be the determinative factor. He endorsed earlier this week in two Clark County House seats. I would expect, but I don't know, that he'll endorse up here. And if he does, that'll probably swing the needle more than anything. But until that point, you're really getting the distillation of the internal fight in the House Republican caucus, where it's, you know, these outsiders who are running on that nationalized campaign against folks who've been around there for a while, like our current congressman, perhaps Settlemyer, who have deep ties to their districts, think about local issues a lot. How that plays out, we see it in D.C., but now we're going to see it in a primary race.
So speaking of President Donald Trump, the MAGA coalition, on the national level, you're seeing that coalition split over U.S. support for Israel and the war in Iran. Are you seeing that play out in this race too?
Not yet necessarily, but I think if this continues, you're going to see those schisms emerge. And I would expect you're going to see folks are really going to emphasize the points of agreement, right? Immigration enforcement, things like that. Where they're going to run differently, and maybe it's to appeal to the president, because again, this is a very safe Republican district, is going to be interesting. You know, breaking with the president in a Republican primary is probably not a recipe for success. But of course, the president's views on, you know, the war in Iran or foreign policy change quite regularly. So, you know, we're talking right now in April. What's going to be happening on Memorial Day? I can't guess. I doubt you can't guess. And I don't think anyone can guess. And so Settlemyer, Filippo, these other Republican candidates are going to kind of have to triangulate what their views are that they're presenting to Republican primary voters on these really hot topics versus a very dynamic and changing environment where even the president is changing his position with some regularity.
And when we're talking about these kind of national level examples of political infighting, that's not limited to Republicans, of course. You're sort of seeing that on the Democratic side, too, especially in some of the parties, the party primaries that are playing out right now. Dissent is messy, of course, but could this be a sign that democracy is working as intended?
I think the idea that candidates are seeing these congressional races as important, that, you know, these seats are up for grabs, that even in a very Republican seat, Democrats are thinking that this is probably the best shot they have, right? An incumbent's retiring. They are hoping for a Democratic wave. They think that if they get the most votes, they're going to go to Washington, D.C. and make a difference. It's attracting an experienced state legislator. It's attracting deep-pocketed, you know, candidate who's ran as an independent before. It's attracting a lot of other folks who, you know, think that this is their time to sort of get their message out about what Democratic politics should be, where it should go. I don't think you'd see that sort of emergence if people thought it didn't matter. And it does matter, right? Who has this seat? Who runs Washington, D.C.? Divided government versus unified government matters a great deal, even in a time where we have the executive branch doing a lot of things that maybe they haven't previously done or doing them in a really forceful way. So to the extent that, you know, elections are certainly part of what makes a country sort of a representative democracy, they're an essential part and you have to have it. I think you're seeing from the candidates, the parties, this sort of view that this is essential. And, you know, it's not something to just sort of throw in the towel or ignore.
Let's turn now to the policy of elections administration itself. President Donald Trump has been trying to change that from the top down, even though the U.S. Constitution reserves that power for Congress. He's filed executive orders to require proof of citizenship and exert control over mail-in ballots to the U.S. Postal Service. Now, courts have already struck down many of those provisions, but could they still have an impact on turnout or elections administration in a state like Nevada?
Sure, and maybe not in ways where the executive orders are creating formal policy. Right. These might be doing a bunch of different things, even if district court judges or appellate court judges are striking them down. So one thing, and this isn't happening in Nevada because the state, Cisco Aguilar is the Secretary of State and he runs elections, but they provide cover for maybe Republican Secretaries of State to implement similar policies and saying, you know, they're following the policies of the federal government, even though, you know, most people aren't tuned into what's going on in the district courts of whatever state that they're in. So it might provide some sort of, you know, opportunity for Secretaries of State in other states to say we're doing this. It also creates confusion, right, for voters who maybe hear a news story or read a social media post about this is the new policy of the government. And, right, what the government means in a certain context can be really hard to parse. I think if we walked out and asked the next 100 people on Virginia Street in Reno and said, who runs federal elections? And I think you'd get a mishmash of answers and people saying, you know, I'm not really sure how exactly it works. And so when that filters down, it makes people unsure about how their mail-in ballot works, when it has to be postmarked by, can they drop it off, does it have to go in the mail, that sort of thing. How that affects turnout may be on the margins in a district like – or in a congressional district like this where it's very heavily Republican. Maybe it doesn't determine a winner, but, you know, these gubernatorial races in this state are super close, right? So a lot of these state-level races are super close. So what happens at the margins at a place like Nevada, especially at the state level, matters a great deal. I would expect that you're going to see a lot of messaging from the Secretary of State in his official capacity as the Secretary of State, but also probably the Democratic Party, even places where Republicans need votes, where confusion might be reigning to sort of say, nah, this is how it works. In Nevada, we're doing it this way. So even though these executive orders may not – don't have the force of law, it doesn't mean that they're not going to affect how people understand how to vote and when to vote and where to vote. And maybe it creates a little bit of confusion for people who don't vote that often.
You mentioned margins. And of course, your point is well taken, especially in a midterm year election. Some of the margins are very, very small. We've seen that with, you mentioned the gubernatorial elections. Then when you get down to the local level, it becomes even crazier in some cases. In terms of turnout, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you expect to see higher than average turnout for a midterm election this year? What do you kind of anticipate in terms of voter engagement?
Yeah, you know, midterm elections, low turnout. As you go further down the ballot, it drops off even more. You know, some of these, you know, state assembly districts, we're talking thousands of votes sometimes, that sort of thing. Just looking at the previous sort of how midterm elections work, when you have when you want to look at the national environment, how the economy's doing, the president's standing, things like that, you would expect disparate turnout where Democrats are going to be really energized, independents that are more Democratic leaning are going to be really energized, and then maybe the folks who voted for Donald Trump, and we do seem to have this cohort of voters who will turn out for Trump but not really turn out for other Republican candidates. That's probably where Republican pollsters and candidates are worried right now, that he has some ability to turn out some set of Republicans in Nevada, especially. I mean, that's nationwide, but certainly in Nevada, that really won him the state last time. They don't seem to turn out in midterm elections at nearly as high of a rate. His first term, we saw this, and we see that across the country, too. So that's probably keeping some Republicans up at night. But, you know, turnout at in a midterm election, always blow a general election. There's probably going to be disparate turnout from a partisan sense here, too, right? Republicans less energized than Democrats.
Thank you so much, Jeremy Gelman with UNR, for having the conversation and going through some of these issues with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was UNR's Jeremy Gelman. He came by the studio earlier this week. Up next, we're joined live by two guests who can break down Nevada's proposed voter ID law. I'm Bert Johnson, filling in for Lucia Starbuck, and this is Purple Politics Nevada. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about the primary for Northern Nevada's 2nd Congressional District. Now, let's turn to a high-profile issue that'll be on the November ballot. Question 7 would amend the state constitution to require voters to show ID at the polls. I'm joined this morning by David Gibbs of Repair the Votes, who supports this change, and Kerry Dermick, with All Voting is Local, is opposed. Mr. David Gibbs, let's start with you. Since this is a proposed constitutional amendment, voters have to approve it in two back-to-back elections. It passed in 2024 with a margin of about 73%. Do you expect it to pass this year too?
Warren Burt, thanks for having me on today and to talk about the voter ID petition. You know, I am comfortable that you know, the voters of Nevada are in favor of voter ID, and so. But I'm not taking anything for granted. I never take anything for granted in an election. We've all seen people who should win, who we think are going to win, who don't win, and people who we think are going to lose, who don't lose. So I don't take anything for granted.
If this measure does become law, how's it going to work? What kinds of ID will people need in order to cast a ballot, for example?
Well, there's a whole list of government-issued photo IDs that are acceptable. Obviously, the one that most people have is driver's license. Over 2 million Nevadans have driver's licenses. Also passports, military ID. If you work for a government entity, federal, state, or local, that will be accept and have an ID from that. That'll be acceptable. If you live in one of the tribal regions, that ID is acceptable. Concealed carry permits acceptable. So there are a long list of IDs that can be. All it basically needs to be is an ID with your name and your picture on it, and the name just needs to match which the name is for that you're registered to vote.
And what about cost? Because some of these ID types are not necessarily free. Is there going to be some kind of provision to provide access to people who can't afford, say, a CCW permit?
Well, see, I mean, if you're going to get a CCW permit, that's totally optional. That's on you. There is a method right now that people can get an ID from the DMV, and that will meet the requirements.
You've said in past interviews this measure will help restore faith in elections, and your organization is called Repair the Vote. So, do you think Nevada elections are broken now?
I think the biggest issue is the fact that people have lost faith and are losing faith in the election process. Back in 2000, there was a poll that was done back in 2005 that showed 6% of the people had lost confidence that the election process was fair and accurate. In 2024, that number had grown to 19%. That's basically one out of five people in this country do not have confidence in the election process. And that does not bode well for our republic. So, people need to have faith, and we need to work on making sure that people can have faith in the system. One way of doing that is making sure that everybody who votes is a legal registered voter, and is that voter. And so this is just one way of doing it. Across the nation, we've seen, for example, in Georgia, they passed this in 2020, a voter ID law in 2021. 2022, the turnout went up. And part of the reason that people talked about it is, they confidence that the election process is fair and accurate. So that's what we're doing here. Trying to make sure that people can have confidence in both the process and in the outcome.
We've seen from the election returns in 2024, of course, that this got a lot of support. In national polling, you also see similar levels of support, and that has to be bipartisan because it's majorities of people who are polled. However, people who are opposed to this kind of measure often say that it risks disenfranchising some people of one of the most important rights in a democratic society. What's your response to those criticisms?
There are 24 states right now that require a photo ID. There is no, I have not heard of anybody anywhere who has not been able to get an ID in one of those states to be able to vote. I would think that if that were happening, you'd hear about it. And so I don't know that that argument holds. And I go back to Georgia in 2021 when this passed. There was a lot of hand-wringing and pronouncing that it was going to hurt minorities who were not going to be able to, who didn't have or not able to get the IDs they needed. Yet in 2022, the percentage went up. So historically, facts are not standing up to that.
In this final stretch before the November general election, in our last 30 seconds or so, what are you doing to help ensure that this is going to pass?
Well, right now our plan is to basically get the word out. I've been going around the state already. I'm here with you this morning. I have done the other interviews. I have my executive director has done some interviews and some talks. So we're getting out around the state and talking to people. As we get closer to the general election, we'll be doing some more. Right now, people are paying attention to the primary or just starting to pay attention to the primary election. So this is something for November. So we'll be getting involved and getting out there a little bit more later this year when folks are starting to concentrate on the general election. It's kind of it's a little early to be really getting out hot and heavy.
Yeah, and that, thank you so much, Mr. Gibbs. We'll have to leave it for there and turn now to Carrie Dermick with All Voting is Local Action. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us this morning. As you heard, there's broad bipartisan support for voter ID laws, both in Nevada and across the country. I'm sure you're well aware of that. Why do you think they're a bad idea, though?
Hi, Bert. Thanks so much for having me today. I really appreciate it. So I think voter ID laws are a bad idea for a lot of reasons. I think one of the first reasons I think they are bad ideas is there have been dozens of studies done actually showing there is large anecdotal evidence that strict voter ID laws actually do disproportionately impact voters of color. So actually in last year and through this year, using county level turnout data across the country, research have actually shown that the racial turnout gap actually grows when states enact strict voter ID laws. So these laws actually do have an impact on our Black and Brown communities. And I think, once again, in my opinion, this is essentially Nevada's SAVE Act. If we pass this year, this is just a slippery slope to essentially what the current administration is trying to do with the SAVE Act, which will lock out millions upon millions of voters. And I think that really is a true issue. The second reason I'm so adamantly opposed against it is really going to be the implementation costs. If we look to Indiana, it cost them $10 million to implement voter ID. And I think in this affordability crisis right now in our state and across the country, I just don't think that it's responsible to spend $10 million implementing something for a problem that just does not exist here in our state.
Faith in elections took a hit after President Donald Trump tried to overturn Joe Biden's victory in 2020. That effort was the so-called big lie. And to this day, Trump falsely claims voting was rigged against him in that race. Proponents say voter ID requirements could help restore some of that faith. But what do you think? Is there a better way to restore faith in U.S. elections than requiring voter ID?
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, I think the one of the reasons we have such a lack of trust in elections right now is because of the mis and disinformation from our current administration around elections. So my advice to people is we have a citizenship, we have a citizen legislator here in Nevada.
And it sounds like we've lost Carrie Dermick from All Voting is Local Action. That's really too bad. Hopefully she'll be able to join us again, but that's how it goes sometimes. In the minutes that we have left, I'm going to turn back to Mr. David Gibbs, if you're still with us, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the efforts around getting out the vote to pass this measure, which you support. Mr. Gibbs, who are you working with in order to get this measure across the finish line?
Well, we have volunteers around the state. The other issue was, or the other thing is, there are a lot of organizations who are in favor of it, who are actually talking to their own folks. I don't have any. We don't have multiple groups. How's that? Who are actually out there pounding the pavement on this? It's all part of helping to get folks elected. A lot of organizations that are in favor of it are talking with their own people about it, is basically what it boils down to.
Got it. Thank you. And it looks like we have Carrie Dermick with All Voting is Local Action back with us. Carrie, can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry about
All
that.
good. No worries. We were just talking about the, perhaps we should say, the alternative methods to restoring faith in U.S. elections. And I think you were mid-thought. Is there anything you'd like to follow up on?
Yeah, no, I really do suggest the public reach out to their election officials. I have relationships with most of them across the state. They're incredibly transparent. They want to serve the public. They want the public to have faith in our elections. They will answer any question that you have about our election systems. And, just for clarity, in 2023, the Institute for Responsive Government actually gave Nevada an A grade when it comes to our elections and our election systems. So I completely understand the public's loss in faith due to the misinformation, disinformation campaign. But seriously, please reach out to your election officials. They are here to serve us and serve you, the voters.
And Carrie Dermick, if this does pass, what is All Voting is Local Action planning to do at that point?
Yeah, so if this does pass, I mean, we 100% completely respect the will of the voters, and we will be heavily involved in the implementation process once it goes to the legislature in 2027. So if it does pass, we understand that, and we are willing to work together with anybody, doesn't matter who, to make sure that this is implemented to hurt the least amount of voters, basically.
And in the final 30 seconds or so that we have today, if it were to pass, what would you like to see the state legislature do in order to help preserve access for as many voters as possible? Are there some changes you have in mind?
I think at this point we're just going to focus on like the current ballot measure and not get too in the weeds of the implementation since we're not there yet. I do want to just bring up, I understand it passed by over 70% in 2024, but the reality is this is a new election. In 2024, over 1 million Nevadans voted in question 7 for or against. There are over 2 million active registered voters right now in Nevada. That's only 50% of the active registered voters that actually voted for it. This is a brand new election, and that's why I'm on here to get our message out. And another really interesting fact
And
about our
Carrie
state
Dermick, I'm
is.
so sorry to interrupt you, but that's all we have time for today.
No problem.
Thank you, Carrie Dermick and David Gibbs, for joining me live on air this morning. I'm Bert Johnson, filling in for Lucia Starbuck, and you've been listening to Purple Politics Nevada.